everyone, and welcome back to the New Plaza Cinema Podcast, the podcast made by cinephiles for cinephiles. Part of the beauty of art is that it allows us to grapple with difficult truths and make sense of the world around us. And with talks of a second Cold War filtering through the news cycle, we decided to revisit the incredibly prevalent 1962 classic, The Manchurian Candidate, starring Frank Sinatra, Angela Lansbury, Lawrence Harvey, and Janet Leigh. Recorded during the apex of the 2020 election, a continuous sense of unease permeates the air as Max Alvarez and Gary Palmucci delve into the insider production scoop, the differences between the film and its literary source material, and its evergreen themes of political domination and scheming, all the while punctuating the talk back with an extensive audience Q&A. So with all that being said, we hope you enjoy this episode.
Good afternoon, everyone. I think The Manchurian Candidate, which is also currently one of my all-time favorite movies, virtually has it all. Thrills, espionage, prescient political skullduggery, pitch black humor, terrific black and white cinematography, envelope pushing scenes of many kinds for its year of production, 1962. Romantic rapture and tragedy, and that's just for starters. Max, I'm sure you can add to that list.
Yes, Gary, I agree with all your points, and I would add that this is also a fascinating film made at the height of the Cold War, and its take on politics and giving us a sense of what some of the Cold War politics were, especially during the Kennedy years, is particularly fascinating. In addition to the participation of its director, John Frankenheimer, and George Axelrod, the screenwriter, and other principals in the cast.
Well, looking at that trailer again today, I think we can say there's at least one line that's not hyperbole or inaccurate in any way. In 1962, you never had seen anything like it. You and I have been talking about there's a couple of kind of unsung heroes in this film, and Max, you dug into this quite a bit. The screenwriter and co-producer with John Frankenheimer, George Axelrod.
Absolutely. George Axelrod, we know, first of all, through some of his Broadway plays in the 1950s, like The Seven-Year Itch, and, you know, sex comedies and so forth.
Success, Boyle Rock Hunter, the great Frank Tashlin, the satire.
Exactly, which was brought to the screen by Frank Tashlin. And a year before Manchurian Candidate, by that time, Axelrod had made the transition to screenplays, and he did the adaptation of Breakfast at Tiffany's. So he wouldn't be the first person you would associate with an intense political thriller, but he certainly was able to bring an element of perverse comedy to the proceedings. And the one thing that jumped out at me many years ago in the late 80s, UCLA had a John Frankenheimer retrospective. Manchurian was not part of that because it was not available at the time. And then a year later, they reissued it. And I was taken aback by the sophistication of the humor in this film, as opposed to other Frankenheimer films, which are a lot more serious. And I would say that Axelrod must have had a great deal to do with that.
We found a great quote that Axelrod said about his screenplay. He said, "It breaks every single known rule. It's got dream sequences, flashback, narration coming out of nowhere. Whenever we got into trouble, we just had a voice explaining stuff. Everything in the world you're told not to do in a screenplay, but that was part of its genetic code, the solution of the crossword puzzle."
Yeah, there is a lot of rules being broken here because there's a narrator at the beginning when we see Raymond Shaw arriving for the Medal of Honor events, and then the narrator disappears for the most part. And yes, there is a lot of unorthodox approaches to the script that Axelrod, and I believe Frankenheimer, uncredited, worked very closely with him. And I have to say, having read the Richard Condon novel, they did an outstanding job in adaptation. We often take for granted the amount of pressures that a director and screenwriter are under when they have to condense a novel down to the screen. And they really did an expert job shifting things around, eliminating some unnecessary characters. Events that took place late in the book were moved to the beginning and vice versa. And really eliminating, I guess, some of the self-indulgent qualities that the novel possessed.
Right, and Richard Condon, who was known for a couple of other novels having to do with political paranoia or doings in the underworld, The Great Prietzi's Honor by John Huston, and a very wacky film called Winter Kills from the 70s, which you should seek out if you've never seen it. And some of the most distinctive dialogue in the film, you reported to me, comes right out of the book, like Angela Lansbury saying, you know, about her son, "Your head looks like it's about to come to a point." I think she says that twice in the film.
Yes, a lot of the dialogue in some of the more memorable scenes was taken from the novel, with the exceptions of a couple of things we'll be talking about. And what fascinated me about the novel was it was dedicated to a movie executive, a man by the name of Max E. Youngstein, who was a very important executive at United Artists, which released Manchurian Candidate.
In its heyday at that point, its history.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this was a studio that had these amazing production deals with very visionary actors and producers and directors, and making the kinds of films that the competing studios would not have had the courage to make. And of course, Gary, you can share more about UA and its personality. But it turns out that Richard Condon was actually working at United Artists in the 50s. He was working as an ad writer, writing some of the ad copy for the studio, hated the work, thought he should be writing novels. And his boss, Max Youngstein, I guess got so tired of hearing this, he began deducting money secretly from Richard Condon's salary. And then a year later, he fired Richard Condon and set up a Mexican bank account with all this money he pilfered, and gave Condon a key to a home in Mexico overlooking the ocean. And he said, now do your writing, write your novel. And the second novel that Condon wrote was The Manchurian Candidate, which he dedicated to Youngstein.
Which came to the attention of JFK. He was a fan of it. And he liked those kinds of books in general, and he recommended it to Sinatra, apparently before they had their falling out, having to do with Sam Giancana, Bobby Kennedy, and so forth. But I think Sinatra felt some sanction or desire to make the film, you know, despite the unconventional aspects of it.
And there was some concern. They were almost afraid to tell Kennedy that they were interested in making the movie, because it does deal with a potential presidential or a candidate being assassinated or being targeted for assassination. And when Kennedy heard that they were going to do the adaptation, he was very excited, because he was, as you mentioned, a fan of the book and was very eager to know who was going to be cast in several of the roles.
There's kind of an urban legend that's grown up around the film that after the Kennedy assassination, Sinatra was somehow kind of spooked by the movie. Of course, we see Lawrence Harvey firing from a balcony, probably not a Mannlich or Carcano rifle, something a little more military, but allegedly because he owned the copyright of the film with John Frankenheimer, ordered it taken out of release for a number of years. But that's not quite true. Apparently, the film was out of release for a number of years. It turned up on television. I think it's when you and I first saw it in the early 70s. I actually booked it in my college film series around that time. And then in 1987, it was shown at the New York Film Festival very successfully. I was at that screening and had a national re-release a year later. And Frankenheimer claimed that it had been withdrawn because he and Sinatra were dissatisfied with the financial deal that United Artists had allegedly not, you know, held up to over the course of its life through theatrical and television release. So that's one of those things I think that needs to be corrected if it's still out there.
And also, I mean, I'm not going to feel too sorry for Frank Sinatra, because half the film's budget went to pay his salary. So I'm not going to worry too much about
it. He was going through kind of a difficult period in his career and his life. At this point, he had left Capitol Records, and he was so angry at Capitol that he recorded his last album called Sinatra's Swinging Session. He allegedly rushed through 12 songs so quickly that the total time of the record was only about 26 minutes. It has to be kind of heard to be believed how he whipped the orchestra through all those numbers. And maybe a little bit of the anxiety of that comes out in his character. He doesn't have any trouble displaying anxiety, certainly at this point in his career. It's out there on the surface.
No, and also there's a scene that I know you and I both admire in the film, where it's the first meeting scene between Sinatra and Janet Leigh on the train.
My name is Ben. Really Bennett. Named after Arnold Bennett.
The writer?
No, Lieutenant Colonel. He was my father's commanding officer at the time.
And that was an intense day for both of them, because Sinatra is processing all the stuff you're sharing with us. And it turns out, according to Jamie Lee Curtis, Janet Leigh's daughter, that Janet Leigh had been served with divorce papers from Tony Curtis that morning. So these poor actors have to still perform with all the stuff hanging over their heads. And yet it certainly adds to the intensity of the moment when the camera starts turning.
And that bizarre dialogue, you know, Columbus is a tremendous football town, Sinatra says. And then he says, are you Arabic too? Or, you know, something to that effect.
Are you Arabic?
No.
Let me put it another way. Are you married?
But as you pointed out, once again, that wacky dialogue, all direct from the book.
All direct from the book. And I remember when Manchurian Candidate was re-released in 87, as you mentioned, the old Premier magazine reprinted that entire dialogue exchange on the train, and the writer was suggesting that the two were speaking in some kind of a code, but it just adds to the mystique of the film.
Right.
And for me, I guess what was disappointing is it was such a strong introduction for Janet Leigh's character, and then she has nothing to do after that scene. She's just kind of there as a respondent to Frank Sinatra's character.
Absolutely.
And most of their scenes could be removed and not have an impact. That's how it was in the actual Conda novel. The role was also underdeveloped. Jonathan Demme resolved this problem when he remade Candidate in 2004, a film that I think has its value. The young woman who plays that character, who approaches Denzel Washington, who is the Frank Sinatra character, she turns out to be on the side of the bad guys.
I'm part of a shadow unit. We've been watching you. Trying to sort this thing out.
This isn't an election. This is a coup. This is, in our own country, a regime change in our own country.
Ben, don't.
And so she's targeted him. And that kind of makes more sense than what we have here. Why is she approaching Sinatra's character on the train? He's clearly so unhinged.
Right.
So that was a little disappointing for me.
Well, we've been talking about that remake also, which was beautifully cast, as is this film. But I have to refresh my memory. It was not a happy experience for Jonathan Demme to make. But getting back to the original, of course, we still have this trio of great stars perfectly cast. Lawrence Harvey, who had made a few Hollywood films at this point, and Angela Lansbury as his diabolical mother, who is really just about his age, right, in his real life at the time.
She was 3 years older than Lawrence Harvey, and she had claimed to someone that, in a way, this was the pinnacle of her acting. She felt that this was such a powerful role for her that every part afterwards almost seemed an anticlimax. I think that was a variation of how she felt about the mother's role, which is such a tense role.
Well, you've studied film editing a lot. I think the brainwashing sequences and the whole setup and so forth in the first couple of reels of the film have some very innovative techniques, do they not?
They do. I'm trying to find the origins. It's not quite French New Wave inspired, where they were abruptly cutting from one scene to another or cutting to somebody in the middle of dialogue, which the French were doing at that time. This is playing, maybe there's a touch of Alain René going on here, but you're playing with time and space. You're intercutting a political brainwashing session with what the people being brainwashed are dreaming and how the Chinese villain suddenly becomes a woman at a garden party, a white woman or a black woman. And the women are picking up the dialogue that the military man is telling to the audience and going back and forth so seamlessly. You certainly didn't see that in a lot of Hollywood films at that time. And I imagine I would love to read the script. Perhaps that was in Axelrod's script. I would think there would have to have been some organization there during the planning stages.
Well, the editor, of course, was a very accomplished cutter. His name is Ferris Webster. He had worked with the great Don Siegel on a number of his pictures. The original Invasion of the Body Snatchers, The Lineup, Dirty Harry, Hell is for Heroes, you know, Fast Montage was the name of the game in a lot of those films. In a completely different mode than this, but still.
As I say, most of the material we see in Manchurian Candidate was in one form or other, in the Conda novel, including the brainwashing scenes, although it wasn't described in the way it was in the film. However, they did add some perverse touches. It was kind of pushing the envelope for violence at that time.
Right.
One man is shot.
And Joe Stalin's face gets decorated with a fusillade of blood, which for 1962, there were a couple of other things that get into that kind of push the envelope.
Yeah, the Stalin symbolism was added for the film. That was not in the original script. And, you know, me, because I'm always the political analyst in these situations, I ask myself, what is the Manchurian Candidate about? What is it saying? Frankenheimer said that what he liked about the film is that it's kind of stuck it to both sides, the left wing and the right wing. He thought that they were equally excessive. We have Axelrod claiming that he was taking pride when the film was reissued in the fact that the American Legion boycotted the movie in the United States in theaters that ran it. And in Paris on the Champs-Élysées, for the French Communist Party protested the film.
That is definitely sticking it to both sides.
Exactly. Now, of course, I'm being the devil's advocate saying, okay, but isn't the movie also saying that McCarthyism and Joe McCarthy, which it brutally satirizes, was a commie plot to take over America?
given everything we've seen happen in the last 4 years, why the hell not? You know what I mean?
And it's funny. And the other thing in watching the movie, who are the heroes here? Well, the Army, the CIA, the FBI. And also, there was a book called National Security Cinema, published a few years ago, which mentions that the Department of Defense cooperated with the making of this film. And the DOD is very hard to cooperate, to get them to cooperate with anything.
Right.
And I'm saying, why would they cooperate with a movie that's making fun of a lot of our political system? Well, could it be sort of sticking it back to Uncle Joe McCarthy for taking on the Army back in 1954 during the Army-McCarthy hearings, claiming that the Army was a hotbed of communism along with the State Department? So it could be a form of getting even with Joe McCarthy as well.
I think an example of another completely different direction of beauty in the film is that scene between Sinatra and Lawrence Harvey where they're both getting drunk on Christmas Eve, the most beautiful scene of sort of male bonding, weeping, romantic longing and despair, which goes into the beautiful flashbacks, you know, Lawrence Harvey meeting his eventual wife who meets tragic circumstances along with her father in the film. And his death scene, another kind of envelope pushing scene, John MacGyver playing that curmudgeonly U.S. senator who I think you found the right description exactly of his death there, right?
Yeah, and before I get to the death, I want to respond to that scene you cited. The Christmas, is it a Christmas Eve male drunken male bonding scene?
Yes.
The camera is stationary for about 4 minutes and 10 seconds. It's just watching these two men. And Axelrod wrote all that dialogue. That was not taken from the book.
Uh-huh.
I call it the I was lovable speech. He's getting drunker and drunker as he talks about Jocelyn. And that was all Axelrod. And that other scene that you mentioned, which is so powerful, when Raymond, under the brainwashing, goes to visit this liberal senator who wants to take down Senator Iceland.
I only hope you haven't been too much upset by these idiotic attacks of Iceland. Actually, I take the position that any attack by Iceland is a great honor. Actually, I haven't had so much supporting mail in the Senate in the last 22 years.
When he's shot with the silencer.
Raymond, hurry it.
He's holding a box of milk. And he literally bleeds the milk of human kindness. So that was a visual in-joke. Presumably, Axelrod had to have been the initiator of this. That is not in the Condon novel. In the novel, it's a very conventional assassination scene. And it's very sad to see the young wife get shot. That was the model Leslie Parrish, who really did a lot of television work before and after and didn't really get another chance to have a role of this stature in her work.
Well, because it makes perfect sense when you say that was a four-minute take between Sinatra and Lawrence Harvey. And at one point, Sinatra makes a reference to Aeschylus, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, the Greek tragedian. And Harvey questions him about that. And Sinatra responds, oh, yeah, a couple of Greeks in a play.
Yeah, no, it was two completely different actors who played off each other quite well. Sinatra is notorious for being very difficult with directors and not wanting to do more than one take. This was well after he started that kind of prima donna policy. Yet apparently, I mean, Frankenheimer was a tough director. I mean, he was good with actors, but he could stood up to them. And he did get Sinatra, presumably, to do more than one take, especially in that scene later in the film where Sinatra visits the Raymond Shaw character in the hotel room across from Madison Square Garden.
The beautifully conditioned links are smashed. They're smashed as of now because we say so. Because we say they ought to be smashed. We're busting up the joint. We're tearing out all the wires. We're busting it up so good, all the Queen's horses and all the Queen's men will never put old Raymond back together again.
And if you look at Sinatra, it's a close shot of his face. The camera's out of focus slightly.
Yes.
And
so I guess they decided that was the best take, and then they were going to go with it, even though these things do happen from time to time. Another movie has been Vertigo. There's a similar shot, right?
Yeah, focusing 35 millimeter is very difficult. You know, you're measuring the distance between the lens and the actor, and you're turning the focus knob, and it's very easy to get it wrong. Here they were focusing on Sinatra's shoulder. That's in focus. His face is not. And there were critics who were pointing how this is a brilliant illustration of the distorted view that the Lawrence Harvey character has of Sinatra, when actually it was just a technical mistake.
Nothing of the sort,
but just Vertigo has a similar mistake.
A relationship between Harvey and Angela Lansbury fascinates us all through the film. At another envelope-pushing moment, we hear Angela Lansbury giving her big speech near the end where Raymond has been, you know, brainwashed once again and about to be sent out on his murderous mission.
You know, this is very important. I want the nominee to be dead about 2 minutes after he begins his acceptance speech, depending on his waiting time under pressure.
And she sort of tries to apologize to him in some way, and there's a disturbingly long kiss between mother and son, which I think has some antecedents and goes even further in the novel.
Yes, in the original novel, she says to him, "Now kiss me, really, really kiss me." And the Condon writes, "Her long fingers dug into his shoulders and pulled him to her on the chaise. And as her left hand opened the Chinese robe, she remembered Papa and the sound of rain high in the attic when she had been a little girl."
Oh, my God.
Finally, there's allusion that there was incest between her and her father, and now there was going to be incest between her and her son. Clearly, there was only so much envelope pushing you can do in 1962 when the censorship code was still very intense.
And then there's that line that she has about, you know, when we take over with powers that will make martial law look like child's play. Well, that has a different, perhaps more immediate sort of chill, unfortunately.
It's a very chilling line. It was not in the Condon novel, believe it or not. The dialogue where she takes Lawrence Harvey's face in her hands and is talking about, you know, basically, "I'm going to get even with you, with them for what they did to you. They've underestimated me." That's in the novel, but that chilling passage that you mentioned was not. That was Axelrod and Frankenheimer.
And of course, to me, the beautiful ending, one of the great endings of Sinatra, reading from the citations of the Medal of Honor and so forth after the horrific climax at Madison Square Garden convention, unlike we'll ever see on television, obviously, but he just kind of looks out the window and sobs. Yeah, that's, to me, that's beautifully done. He had a perhaps a limited range of an actor, but he could do certain stuff beautifully.
Absolutely. And that scene that you mentioned also was added for the film. The novel pretty much ends at the convention after Sinatra's character emerges from that booth where Raymond presumably has killed himself. So they added that for the film. And also, the beauty of movies of this era is you didn't have those endless credits at the end. And it's like the lightning bolt is heard and it just says the end.
That's right.
Released by United Artists and we're done.
United Artists was very no-nonsense. They didn't even have a logo.
No, exactly. That's why I always take personal offense today when you watch a United Artists movie and they always put the MGM logo on there.
Well, at New Plaza Cinema, United Artists is still revered as a company. They're basically a shell of themselves right now. They belong to another conglomerate or two, but United Artists was originally formed by four titans of the movies in 1919, Chaplin, Pickford, Fairbanks, and D.W. Griffith, of course.
United Artists was very, very unusual. The regime of the 1950s, Robert Benjamin, Arthur Krim, they were attorneys who took cinema very seriously. They were also very politically connected in Democrat circles, so they were big champions of Kennedy, and they were very politically minded filmmakers. UA, ironically, was also very much entrenched in Cold War politics, because you do see a lot of films representing Cold War issues from the State Department perspective at that time.
There's yet another in-joke in the film where we see the presidential nominee's name is Benjamin Arthur, which is an in-joke to the Arthur Krim and Bob Benjamin, the two top executives of the company at that time.
I didn't catch that. That's amazing. So when the film was reissued, Axelrod was telling people, it's okay to laugh. Axelrod saw this as more of a comedy in many ways, where it's easy not to see it as a comedy. And certainly after 1963, it was hard to laugh at this film. But these little in-jokes you're talking about just point to that.
Well, there's a fascinating three-way interview which appears on the Criterion and possibly the other commercial DVD releases of the film, which was shot in 1988, the year of that reissue, with Sinatra, Frankenheimer, and Axelrod in a room trying to have like a freewheeling discussion about the film. But you can see there's a subtle level of tension. You do not want to say anything that Frank is not going to agree with, almost like he's a mafia don or something, and they don't want to say something they're going to regret about the film or push that idea too far or whatever. But that's yet another fascinating footnote to it to me.
I mean, I certainly think it's one of Sinatra's finest and rawest performances.
Yeah.
And I think he preferred the performance he gave in Vincent Minnelli's Some Came Running. But this is certainly...
I love that film. You reminded me of a very bizarre footnote in Sinatra's filmography from the early 50s, evidently made before From Here to Eternity, a low-budget independent film called Suddenly, in which he plays a drifter who's trying to assassinate the President of the United States at a railroad crossing as his train passes through some Midwestern town, and a film that's fallen into the public domain but can still easily be found.
And that was part of the whole mythology of The Manchurian Candidate. It was rumored that Sinatra kept this movie and that movie out of release after Kennedy was killed, because they both dealt with assassinations. But as you say, it suddenly was already on the route to its public domain being available anyway.
Well, I imagine we're ready for some questions.
Absolutely. 1 second, Barry. There you go.
There we go. Hi, I'm Max. Hi, Gary.
Good to see you.
Gary.
Good to see you again, Max. What went on in the minds of casting agents in those days? I think back to The Graduate, and Anne Bancroft being maybe 6 or 8 years older than Dustin Hoffman, and Angela Lansbury being only 3 years older than Lawrence Harvey. And what was the press response to it? But also, casting of two British actors, both Lansbury and Harvey, couldn't quite hide their British accents at times. It was quite noticeable and a little troublesome at times, in spite of the fact that their performances were brilliant. So there's two or three questions rolled up there.
And they're all great questions. The first one, who made those decisions? I mean, you did have agents pushing their clients on studios when they heard a film was in production. Sometimes it was a director or producer that wanted a specific actor. Believe it or not, Lucille Ball was being pushed by Sinatra to play the mother in the film. But Frankenheimer was very pleased with Angela Lansbury, having directed her just before this movie in All Fall Down. This was a big year for Frankenheimer. He had 3 movies come out.
It's an amazing year for him.
And so he wanted Angela Lansbury for the mother. And also casting British actors, that was a more unusual thing to do at the time, because the British artists hadn't yet figured out a way to put American actors out of work with their pitch-perfect accents that they do now. And they can do flawless Brooklyn accents, Jersey accents, and you can't even tell, Australian actors as well. In the early 60s, they hadn't figured it out yet. So as you pointed out, you still hear some of the British accents in Harvey.
He'd been in a few Hollywood films. He was in Summer and Smoke from Tennessee Williams, The Alamo with John Wayne, Butterfield 8 with Elizabeth Taylor. So he was riding some kind of a cusp at that point. But you and I were talking about this. Is that some kind of New England preppy accent, or what? You know, what's going on there?
It sounded very preppy. But when you're listening to Lawrence Harvey talk, he has such a mesmerizing voice that it sort of transcends whatever awkwardness we might feel in terms of the accents. And in terms of how the critics responded, I mean, I didn't question the age difference between Angela and
I don't have a credibility problem with that.
Graduate, where you believe Anne Bancroft in that role, and that's the brilliance of the performer as well.
There's an interview with Angela Lansbury where she describes how to play that mama when she realizes she's about to be shot after her husband was, and she describes it beautifully. It's on YouTube and elsewhere.
I've got to find that. She certainly does look a lot older than Harvey, adding age lines or something.
Yeah, and sometimes if the movie is really compelling and the director knows what they're doing, they'll just do the most obviously inconsistent and illogical things and we won't notice. And that's one of them. And not a great film, but when Ken Russell made Tommy in the 70s, he deliberately did not age Anne Bancroft through the entire film, even though decades passed and nobody questioned it.
Do we mean Anne Margaret there, Max? Actually?
I'm sorry, Anne Margaret. Thank you, Gary. At least someone here knows what he saw.
Yes. I'm now reliving those beans coming through the television screen.
Exactly.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Barry.
Marjorie, please go ahead.
Yes. Well, watching this film, a few Shakespearean things occurred to me. When after the would-be president was to be shot, then her husband was supposed to carry his bloody body and, you know, protest, which is directly out of Julius Caesar, where Mark Antony holds Caesar's bloody body, and how the most vociferous anti-communists were communists themselves. And that reminded me of Hamlet with, he thinks the lady doth protest too much. So those two themes really stuck out in my mind. And also Freud, to accuse is to confess. And I always think of these things when people are so outspoken against whatever group or people, that hidden inside, there's something of that in them.
There's a lot of, I think, Lady Macbeth in her, you know, pushing her husband to take over the king's position and that kind of thing. And there's the Oedipus complex issue going on there as well.
I saw Shakespeare through the whole thing.
And over a great observation.
Thank you.
Thanks, Marjorie.
Daniel, there you go.
Okay. I would be remiss if I did not cite, for all of the other listeners, a marvelous resource in particular with regard to John Frankenheimer. The DVD of Manchurian Candidate has a brilliant director's commentary. If you are even remotely interested in the craft of filmmaking and some of the decisions that go into it, and a lot of Frankenheimer's storytelling strategy, where he had to make sure scene A made sense so that scene B would make sense also. He goes into great detail on that, and he also does in the DVDs of The Train, Seconds.
His commentary for 7 Days in May is outstanding as well.
Yes, he was quite an interesting guy who incidentally got his start in live television, which was a real hotbed of tension.
Baptism of fire.
He tells some great anecdotes when there was golden age of TV presentations that were put out on PBS years ago. He told a lot of stories about his TV days. And it's sad because there was a bit of an artistic downfall in the later part of the decade. 6 years after Manchurian Candidate, making these remarkable films, as you mentioned, he is the California campaign manager for Robert Kennedy. And Robert Kennedy is staying at Frankenheimer's home in Los Angeles at the time he gets killed. And that was devastating to Frankenheimer.
Yeah.
And he really hit some hard times after that. It seems like the shift, in my opinion, to color was disappointing. I think his black and white films are fantastic. The color work becomes very disappointing to me, but there was also a personal decline that took place. There would be a really interesting film followed by an absolutely dreadful one.
Yeah.
And after Manchurian Candidate got reissued, more job offers came along, and we see Frankenheimer starting to get his mojo back, making some films for HBO on George Wallace, the Attica prison uprising. Gary mentioned Andersonville, and it's kind of the old John Frankenheimer coming.
And in the 70s, he did make a couple of pictures that are worth seeking out. The French Connection 2, shot almost entirely on location on the streets of Marseille. I think that's surprisingly good. The Gene Hackman gave it all. And also his film of The Iceman Cometh, which I think includes every syllable of The Iceman Cometh. 4 hours long, beautiful cast. Lee Marvin as Hickey, that's a little unconventional, but Frederick March, Jeff Bridges, Moses Gunn, terrific rendition of that, and that's easy to find these days.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Daniel. Joan?
I read somewhere that some critics question the weird dialogue between Ben and Rosie on the train when they meet, when she says, Maryland is a beautiful state, and he says, we're in Delaware. And then she makes some comment, she's one of the Chinese people who worked on the lot. Some people thought it speaks to a ultimate conspiracy, which is never spelled out. And I wondered what you thought of it.
All I would say is that somehow, to me, that romantic banter on the train, it works because it's so off the wall somehow. And Sinatra is so burned out in that scene. Stuff is rolling off his tongue, you know, in some kind of stream of consciousness. And she's just playing along with it, also playing it very straight. There's no meet cute scene like that in movie history that I can think of. And that's what makes it so beautiful.
Point well made. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Great.
We're going to go to Marianne. You're going to go through some of our questions.
Yes. First of all, did they have any Oscar nods for this movie?
Few, if any, that year.
Number 62 is an intense year. You've got major competition that year from, what are some of the films that year, Gary?
Lawrence of Arabia, To Kill a Mockingbird, A Bloated Spectacle, The Longest Day. I think Daryl Zanuck pushed that to a Best Picture nomination. David and Lisa, one of the most successful independent films of that kind, at that time, rather, got some recognition.
So no,
I think the film was moderately successful, but not a big hit.
Yeah, it may have been recognized in the categories, but no wins as far as I know.
And the other question is the two candidates. What state are they representing? Do you know?
All I can tell you is in the novel, the convention took place in New Jersey, not at Madison Square Garden. But I don't recall what states they represented, Gary.
Yeah, I think that's kind of buffed over. And we don't even know what state Senator Island is from.
They're very clever when they make these films. They don't tell you what party they're with or what states they're with. So
maybe Pennsylvania because of the Heinz ketchup thing or something. That
could be.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Marianne.
Thanks, Marianne. Howard, good to go.
I would like to call everyone's attention to the scene where Fred Sinatra is identifying people from the slides he's being shown. I don't know where the studios or the producers get pictures like that. But just shortly before the two, which he noticed, on the left side, one of the pictures looked horrifically like Lee Harvey Oswald. And I wonder if he was in any way known then to be some low-level guy in political something or other, and somehow they got a picture of him from the news and they stuck it in there. But I want to go back and look at it again. Is it possible?
That sounds like a long shot to me because that was so far in the future.
Right.
But you've motivated me to go back and check my DVD for that.
Yeah, I mean, the picture was probably shooting sometime in 1961. I think Oswald, he had probably been to Russia and come back at this point, but had not really attracted any serious attention. Maybe he was involved in that Fair Play for Cuba business, and maybe the FBI might have noticed him, but I think that's still too early.
I don't know if these were stock pictures or if they got them out of the news or what, but, you know, I'm just saying.
Yeah, in situations like this, it's sometimes a combination of both, where if they get clearance to use a photo, they'll use it, or if they can make it look like an archival photo, they'll try to do that too.
The only thing to go back and look.
Thank you.
We're going to go to Karen next.
Hi, I have a question about the playing cards. Not being a card player much myself, it looked to me as though the queen, the face of the queen on all the cards, looked amazingly like Angela Lansbury.
Great.
And my question is, were the playing cards altered in any way, or was it just all of us projecting?
I certainly see Angela Lansbury on those cards. I think the irony could not have been lost on Axelrod and Frankenheimer. The cards are such an important motif in the marketing of the film and in our image of the film. I don't know if Gary has...
Whether they somehow customized the cards or not, I think we have to go back.
You have to go back and check.
Pull your deck and hold it up to a freeze frame there and see what's there.
But certainly in the marketing and the ads for Manchurian Candidate, when you see the Red Queen, the face definitely looks like Angela Lansbury.
Yes. Thank you.
Yo.
Thanks, Karen. So, Eleanor, you should be good to go.
Okay. At the beginning, you mentioned that Sinatra makes this reference to Aeschylus, and he talks about two characters, Clytemnestra and Orestes. So it's very telling because I looked it up as soon as he said that. Clytemnestra was Orestes' mother. Agamemnon was his father. She induced her lover to kill Agamemnon. And years later, Orestes kills her. So, you know, it's as if we were watching Hamlet or Oedipus, which we know so much better. There's the foreshadow right there. And it was interesting to me, since that's such a strong foreshadow for people who know Greek mythology, that when in the remake, they eliminated that reference. They said, no, nobody's going to get it. So
that's a fantastic observation. We'll go ahead, Gary.
That's a whole new layer of understanding now. Nobody can deliver that line like Frank, couple of Greeks in a play.
Yeah.
And what I thought was amusing about the remake, because by the time the film was remade, the Cold War, I mean, the Soviet Union was no longer. For the Jonathan Demme film, they changed the villains to a transnational corporation called Manchurian Global that controls the military-industrial complex. But thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, very valuable. Thank you.
This discussion was facilitated by film historian Max Alvarez and resident film curator Gary Palmucci. Also, special thanks to Norma Levy, Marianne Tesler, Sean Moore, and Polly Rittenberg for making the production of this podcast possible. This podcast was produced, edited, and narrated by Hannah Kavanaugh. Yours truly. Thank you so much for tuning in, everyone, and take care.